This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The Academy Award presentations are Sunday, and our first guest, Philip Seymour Hoffman, could come away with his second Oscar in 3 years. Hoffman is nominated for Best Supporting Actor for his performance in the movie Doubt, which has earned 4 other nominations, including Best Actress for Meryl Streep. Hoffman won the Oscar for Best Actor in 2006 for his portrayal of Truman Capote in the movie Capote. He's also given memorable performances in Charlie Wilson's War, The Savages, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Happiness, and Boogie Nights. Terry spoke to Philip Seymour Hoffman in December. Doubt was adapted for the screen by John Patrick Shanley from his hit play of the same name. It takes place in 1964 in a Catholic school. Meryl Streep plays the strict and old-fashioned principal. Hoffman is a priest and gym teacher who wants a more open atmosphere in the school. The principal distrusts him and urges a new young teacher played by Amy Adams to keep an eye on him. The young teacher suspects the priest has an improper relationship with a 12-year-old boy named Donald Miller, who's the school's only African-American student. In this scene, the principal and the young teacher have summoned the priest to talk about the school's Christmas pageant, but they have other things on their minds.
The Christmas pageant. We must be careful how Donald Miller is used.
Oh, easy there, sister. All right, what about Donald Miller?
We must be careful in the pageant that we neither hide Donald Miller nor put him forward.
Because of the color of his skin?
That's right.
Yeah. Why?
Oh, come, Father.
I think you should be treated like every other boy.
Were you yourself singled a boy out for special attention? You held a private meeting with him at the rectory a week ago?
Yes.
What are we talking about?
Donald Miller.
The boy acted strangely when he returned to class.
He did?
When he returned from the rectory, a little odd, yes.
Can you tell us why?
How did he act strangely?
I'm not sure how to explain it. He laid his head on the desk and...
Do you mean you had some impression?
Yes.
I didn't come from the rectory, so you're asking me.
Mm. That's it.
Did you want to discuss the pageant? Is that why I'm here? Is this what you wanted to discuss?
This.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
The story in Doubt is all about doubt versus certainty about whether you are a predator or a protective mentor. And the audience is left with doubts about this, too.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to know when you're performing in this film if you abuse the boy or not?
Yeah, because if I didn't, I'd be playing the janitor or something, you know.
That's what I was wondering, right.
You know what I mean?
I
get that question a lot, and it's odd because I've never gotten that question about any other part I've played because every other part just assumes because I'm playing the part. But for here, people somehow think I'm a audience member. When actually, no, I played the guy, so I have to have filled in his history. But that history is mine, and I would never share it because it would just so destroy the experience of the moviegoer. But yes, I do have to fill that history in the way that I feel is that I found most compelling.
So you're confident that you know what the character is. What your character did and didn't do. Do you know that because you decided or because you spoke to the playwright John Patrick Shanley and he told you?
Well, I have to know because I'm playing the man or else he'd be psychotic.
An amnesiac. Yes, or psychotic.
Yeah, I'd be playing a guy who has a memory problem. which is so, you know, and he's not psychotic and he doesn't have a memory problem. So, you know, John, I talked to John in private and he, you know, we had a conversation about it. And I took what was helpful from that and what I was thinking about and kind of filled it in. And it's a wonderful thing because it really could be anything. You know, it's this amazing thing how he set it up where, you know, the stakes are so high that you realize if the stakes are so high that it could be anything. It could be so many things. And that's what I found so interesting. Because ultimately it comes about his past. Do you know what I mean? Because she says that she's delved into his past when we find out later that that's not true. But he's led to believe that she did. So he's really – he could be hiding something from his past that has nothing to do with anything that she's accusing him of. And I just found that fascinating and I could really, you know, use my imagination.
Since you were privy to some of the playwright-screenwriter's thoughts – on what your character did and didn't do. Was Meryl Streep privy to those thoughts too, or was she kept in the dark as her character?
No, of course not. Uh-huh. Of course not. No. No, Meryl, no one.
No one but you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, the fact that she would even be privy to anything like that would be detrimental. So because then she would know something and she shouldn't know anything.
Did you talk about
scenes? She doesn't know anything.
Did you talk about scenes with her before doing them?
Yeah, the scenes we were in.
So what kind of discussion do you have about a scene before doing it when you're working with her?
Well, you're with a director, too, so it's not like you're talking about it through a director and together, you know, and it's a lot of problem solving. You know, how do I get from here to there? Mm-hmm. How do I get from that beat to that beat? What's the event? You know, what's our relationship? How long have we been working here? You know, when did we first meet? When did this start, this antagonism? You know, what was this something else that happened? Where did I come from? You know, those are all things that, you know, you talk about. And but that very issue of whether, you know, she's accusing of is true or not, never. Because I wouldn't. Because I won't. Because it doesn't happen.
The late Anthony Minghella directed you in a couple of films, Cold Mountain and The Talented Mr. Ripley. And he was quoted in an article as saying this about you. Philip is an extraordinary actor, cursed sometimes by his own gnawing intelligence, his own discomfort with acting. Does that sound right to you, that you have, like, your intelligence is sometimes like a curse and that you're uncomfortable sometimes with acting?
I miss him.
I bet
really
you do. Yeah.
I really do. Wow. Took me by surprise of that. I think I'm as intelligent as the next guy. I think that the amount of concentration, sometimes the amount of personal exploration it takes to do something well can be not pleasant. You know, like hard work is. That doesn't mean you don't want to do it or you don't love it or that it's not ultimately satisfying. You know, that old cliche, you know, nothing's worth it unless it's hard to do kind of thing. I wear that on my sleeve sometimes when I'm working. And I think because I trusted Anthony so much. And I think, and he got to know me, you know, like all really, really fine directors do. They allow you to be who you are. The best and the worst of you is allowed to show up at work. And they are okay with that because they know that that the actor needs an environment of trust. And he was one of those people, so he gets to know me probably better than some people that might have known me longer. So he's probably referring to that. And he's a very intelligent man and obviously very insightful. And he's right. You know, I think I do wear that discomfort of sometimes the process, that the creative process of something, and so sometimes that's not pleasant. On my sleeve, and I think that's what he was talking about.
What is that discomfort with?
Well, you know, when you're shooting a film, day can be 10, 12 hours long usually, and you have to stay in a certain place through that time because you're at any moment you'll be called to do what you do. And you've done a lot of work and prepared a lot of things, and the level of concentration it takes to kind of keep those plates in the air That's what's tiring about the job. Like any job, everything has. There's always something about that job that's exhausting, and that's what's exhausting about acting is the level of concentration over a very long period of time. And if there's something emotional about what you're doing that day, you're carrying that emotion in one level or another for a long period of time. If you think about life, we're not too introspective. We don't walk around our lives just constantly trying to delve into the understanding of ourselves, unless you're in therapy or something. But that's what actors do. You know, we really explore ourselves and other people and all that stuff. And if you're carrying that around and the emotional life of that around over a period of time, it can be burdensome. But it's part of the work, and you're trying to create something artful out of it. And so it's not therapy, so you're not there to be in therapy. You're there to take, you know, what you know and the experiences and behavior and emotional life of yourself and others and try to make something artful out of it. But the carrying of that around and the focusing of that can be tough.
Have you been in therapy? And if so, was that useful or not for acting?
No, I've never been to therapy for acting.
No, I don't mean therapy for acting, but
no, but, therapy. You know, but that would be my answer, though. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
I've never been in therapy for acting. That's for sure.
Let's talk about your performance that won the Oscar for Best Actor in 2006, and this is the film Capote, in which you played Truman Capote. What's it like to play somebody who's real? And we have documentation of how he looked and sounded. When you agreed to take the role, were you at all worried that you would end up doing like an impersonation as opposed to, you know, that kind of interior acting that you're used to doing?
Well, I wasn't worried about that because I'm not good at impersonation. So I knew that I wouldn't be able, I knew that that wouldn't be my forte. You know, I think there's other people that probably do a much better and that do a much better impersonation of Truman Capote than I ever will. I just knew because his behavior was so extreme that I had to have some semblance of what it was, some sense of behavior and voice that what it was so people would follow me, you know. So I got a sense of it to the best of my ability that still allowed me to connect to an inner life and of my understanding that his would be and just kind of jumped, you know, and went for it. But no, I was never scared of that because I knew I never really would do that as well as I would hopefully do the acting of the part, you know. I had to let go of that after a certain point, but I knew I had to do something. And so what you see is as specific as I could get and still be able to act the part as well as possible. Because that stuff isn't really acting. That stuff is technical stuff that you kind of have to weave into the personal life and the intention and the drive and the passion of the character.
Let's talk about the technical stuff for a moment, like developing the voice that you use for Capote. How did you find the voice you were going to use?
By just watching stuff on him, you know what I mean? And just kind of, I have a very low voice, lower than most. And it's not very sing-songy. And I remember the first time I'd heard him before when I was a kid on The Tonight Show and stuff, I guess. But it had been a while, you know. And so when Bennett showed me this documentary by the Maisels.
This is the director.
Yeah. Bennett Miller. I remember he put it on, and I was just like, oh, Christ, oh, no. And I literally thought, like, oh, this is a disaster. What did I do? I mean, literally, I was like, what did I do? Because I'd already said yes. And I was kind of, my head bowed, you know.
because what?
Because it was so extreme. I saw him and saw his behavior and saw him talk, and I was just like, I'm never going to be able to get a sense of that, to get people to follow me. You know, and then I just started working. I said, all right, you know, and I just got all the tapes I could, audio tapes, video tapes, and I just started training in a way, you know, to get as close as I could a sense of his behavior, you know, and that it's like, because all you got to do is really get close enough, you know, get a sense of something, and the people kind of will, you know, if people go, they see, and they immediately. If you're getting a sense of something and there's true acting going on, they give over. You know what I mean? Because they want to give over because what they're watching is true. the impersonation is really not interesting anymore. It's really about your belief in the circumstances of this character and what they're going through, and that you buy that story and that character's journey. As long as what you're doing is honest, and that was just me doing the best I could to facilitate that transfer of belief, that leap of faith for everybody in the audience.
Why don't we hear a scene from the film? I mean, in the film, Capote dramatizes the period of Truman Capote's life when he's writing In Cold Blood, his nonfiction book about two killers who massacred a family in cold blood. And so in this scene, you're in prison visiting with one of the alleged killers, Perry Smith, played by Clifton Collins Jr. And you've kind of befriended him. And, your friendship is paying off because the more of a friendship there is, the more comfortable he feels with you, the more he tells you about himself. And you've also just done him a favor. You've found a lawyer, a different lawyer for him, and he's very grateful for that. And this scene happens just after you've hit on the title In Cold Blood for your book. So here you are in the prison cell with Perry Smith right after you've found him the lawyer, and he's grateful.
Thank you.
It's as much for me as for anyone. I couldn't bear the thought of losing you so soon.
We're going to be able to use your book for our case. You're right. We never got to raise an insanity plea. You wrote how terrible the lawyers was.
I haven't written a word yet.
What have you been doing?
Research. Talking to you.
All right.
I had hoped...
What are you calling it?
The book? I have no idea. Perry... If I'm going to write about you, if I'm going to determine how to write about you, we need to talk about why you're here. The murders that night at the Clutter House. Do you worry what I think? Is that it?
Dick says you know Elizabeth Taylor.
I know a lot of people. Perry, I have invitations to be in Morocco and Greece. And I prefer to be here. With you.
That's Philip Seymour Hoffman as Truman Capote in the film Capote. That's the role he won an Oscar for. You play Capote with this really interesting mix of like empathy and manipulation, and it's hard to tell where one ends and the other begins. Did you read a lot about Capote before figuring out how to portray him and what you thought his motivations were?
Yeah, I did. And it was helpful because what you said, I think, is very accurate. I don't think you could tell where his empathy ended and where his manipulation began. I think that became worse and worse and became more and more detrimental and affected a lot of people. You know, there's a lot of people that I've run into since I made the movie who knew him, who either adored him or hated him. There wasn't many middle ground. There wasn't a lot of middle ground. And that scene is a perfect example. That scene, he's lying. He's just lying. It's the beginning of the really harsh betrayal. Perry Smith needs, empathy. But the fact that Truman Capote was empathetic and was getting close to this person and was ultimately using this person for his own gain, that lying started to become something that was soul-eating, you know. That's the movie, you know. And in that scene, you see him being incredibly empathetic, but his empathy is littered with lies right to his face. So it's a very it's a very troubling story, very troubling character, you know. And, yeah, all that stuff I wanted to know about, you know, and all the ways he kind of did it. And I did read and talk to people and stuff like that.
Now, before you started acting, you were a wrestler in high school. I mean, that was I think, your main sport?
I was a wrestler. baseball was my thing. I was a baseball player until I was probably like a sophomore. And I was a wrestler 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. And it was in 9th grade when I was on the junior varsity wrestling team. That's when I injured myself. And that's when I started going out for plays. But I was, I was a big athlete up till like freshman, sophomore year of high school. I loved sports. I still love sports. Sports is still a huge passion of mine. I was baseball, football, wrestled. Football only 2 years, so I didn't like getting hit.
What was your injury when you were a wrestler?
It was a neck injury. I was in a neck brace for a while. I almost had to have surgery on it. It was a serious thing that, you know, basically the doctors just said, you know, you can't get hurt like that again. You know, it was kind of, he's saying there's enough of a weakness that's in your neck now because of that, you know. So I didn't wrestle anymore. I probably would have kept doing it if I hadn't gotten injured. Anyway, I went out for a play and the rest kind of just unfolded, you know.
So did the neck injury that made you give up wrestling lead to acting?
Well, I just, you know, because I went to the theater when I was young with my mother. It always comes back to the mother, doesn't it? my mother took me to the theater when I was probably seriously started taking me when I was probably 12. And she took me to the Jiva Theater in Rochester, New York, which was the Equity House there. It was in a small house at that time. The first play I saw was All My Sons. And so she took me to serious stuff, new plays, you know, stuff, the American classics and stuff like that. So, and I just adored it. I thought it was a miracle. I thought it was magic, you know. I just couldn't get enough of it. But I was still, you know, there wasn't anything I wanted to do. I thought, I'm just going to go to theater all my life and you know, and maybe watch baseball, you know. And so when I injured my neck, my mom's like, go for a play, you know. She has huge passion. She's a huge passion for the athletics, huge sports fan, and she's a huge theater fan. So she was all for it, you know, both. And
so you didn't see a big dichotomy between sports and theater?
No, I think they're the same. The same what it takes to be a great athlete is the same thing what it takes to be a great actor, I think. That kind of concentration and that kind of privacy in public and that kind of unselfconscious kind of experience are very similar, and that kind of pressure of the people watching and finding privacy in front of all that stuff. So, you know, I find it very similar.
Now, I read, and I don't want to dwell on this, but I read that when you were 22, I think it was right after you got out of the NYU's Tisch School for the Arts, that you had been drinking and using pills and went into rehab. So I assume that you don't drink anymore. Is that because a lot of people who do that like feel like they can't drink. So my question is, if it's true that you can't drink, what do you do when, like, you see people like really enjoying their wine and their beer or their, you know, cognac or whatever. Like, do you resent it? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, do you have to? Does it make you feel resentful that there's this like great pleasure out there and like you can't have any?
Well, I don't think it's a great pleasure. Do you know what I mean? Meaning, like, I understand. I mean, I do think it's a great pleasure, but I think that anyone who's enjoying that pleasure too much, I'm always like, okay, well, that's good. I'm glad you're enjoying that. You know, people who don't have a problem with alcohol don't have a problem with alcohol. You know, and they have their couple glasses of wine and they go on their way. You know what I mean? And that's just the way it is. I'm just not one of those people. So it's, you know, a couple glasses of wine is, you know, not interesting to me at all. Do you know what I mean? That's what I meant by it's not a great a great pleasure for me to have a couple glasses of wine. That's kind of annoying. Do you know what I mean? Like, why aren't you having the whole bottle?
Right. I got
That's
it.
That's much more pleasurable. Do you know what I mean? So it's somebody who doesn't understand that. They just don't understand it. You know, they're just – so if I see somebody really enjoying their one glass of wine and walking away, then that's what they enjoy. And so, but I can't be resentful of that because that's not enjoyable to me.
Why have you decided in your career to use three names, Philip Seymour Hoffman?
It's a union thing. I wish it was more romantic or special or obnoxious, but it's not. I was when I started out, there was another Philip Hoffman who spelled exactly like me, who was successful in musical theater. I was on Broadway, and at that time, the union asked you to change your name. And so I thought, well, I'll put my middle initial in, you know, and that wasn't enough. And so eventually you either change it. You couldn't change just a letter. I remember all that, going through all that. Because what happens is that you end up getting each other's checks and stuff. Like, things get messed up.
Oh.
And I in fact, I remember back then getting his checks or him getting my – I remember that actually happening. And so that's why. So I was like, well, you know, that was my grandfather's name. So I'll put that in there and we'll go from there.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, he's up for an Oscar for his role in the movie Doubt.